You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
Today, how LIGO's detection of gravitational waves could open a new window on the universe.
You could imagine that in the future, when we have incredibly precise data, we will uncover something peculiar that goes beyond the current theory and requires some new science.
Searching for wrinkles in space-time that could reveal the secrets of quantum gravity.
So if you want to look for space-time defects, you want to look at some particle that travels over a really long distance.
And a quantum horror story asks if you're afraid of the monster under the bed.
In a parallel world in which a mirror Anna also looked under her bed before going to sleep and after saying her prayers, and where, up until then, she'd never found anything bad, this time, there would be a ghastly demon with wicked teeth and blood-stained claws whose only desire was to catch and tear apart Anna, aged 6¾ years.
He's Brendan Foster.
And she's Zia Morali.
Welcome back to the podcast from the Foundational Questions Institute. We took a bit of a long break at the beginning of the year when we went into hibernation.
Only to be briefly disturbed in February when we were nudged awake by a passing gravitational wave. And then a weasel chewed through the podcast cable and knocked us offline for a couple more months.
Indeed. I hear that intrepid weasel then went on to shut down the LHC in April and then sadly died. But as you alluded to, Brendan, the big announcement was from the LIGO collaboration, who detected gravitational waves, ripples in the fabric of space-time, and that unsurprisingly makes up our lead story in this edition. Brendan has been investigating how these waves could be used to test the limits of our understanding of gravity. But before we get to that, we should mention that there was another experiment in the news in April, which will also be testing the foundations of physics.
That's right. France's Microscope satellite experiment was launched into orbit to test the equivalence principle.
Now, we usually talk about the equivalence principle in the same breath as Einstein, because it forms the bedrock of his theory of gravity, general relativity. But Microscope is recreating an experiment we usually associate with Galileo.
Galileo reasoned that if you drop two objects off the edge of the Leaning Tower of Pisa, they should both hit the ground at the same time, regardless of their mass or what they are made of. Even a feather and a hammer should, in theory, hit the ground at the same time in the absence of air resistance.
That hammer-feather experiment was famously carried out on the moon in the 1970s by Apollo 15 astronaut Dave Scott.
And a friend of the FQXI podcast, neuroscientist David Eagleman, repeated the test by hurling graduate students off a tower to...
He did, but I don't think that was to put Galileo to the test, Brendan.
No, you could be right. Eagleman probably threw his students off a building just for fun. But seriously, on the podcast page, fqxi.org/community/podcast, we will put a link to Eagleman's interview with Zia in which he explains how those tests helped him better understand how the human mind perceives time.
But back to the equivalence principle. The point is, Galileo's prediction has been verified to tremendous accuracy in labs on Earth, to one part in 10 trillion, according to the European Space Agency's press release. But that accuracy is limited because experimenters have to shield the tests from seismic activity and anything else that could disrupt the results. In space, they can improve the accuracy at least 100 times, which is their plan.
The microscope experiment uses two pairs of nested cylinders. In one pair, both cylinders are made of the same material, an alloy of the heavy metals platinum and rhodium. In the other pair, the inner cylinder is platinum and rhodium, and the outer one is an alloy of light metals, titanium, aluminum, or aluminium, and vanadium?
Vanadium, yeah.
Or vanadium.
I don't know.
Titanium, aluminium, and vanadium. If the equivalence principle is correct, then as Microscope orbits Earth, all four cylinders should feel the same pull and move in the same way. Any deviation would be a sign of the breakdown of the equivalence principle.
And that would be exciting news. Physicists have been struggling to unite the general theory of relativity, which describes the motion of cosmic bodies, with quantum theory, which describes the behaviour of atoms and subatomic particles. So any experimental evidence that could help them get to grips with how general relativity may break down would be immense.
There are some alternative theories, some versions of string theory, for instance, that predict that the equivalence principle should be violated. This might also have implications for the existence of dark matter. Most physicists believe that the bulk of matter in the universe takes a mysterious, invisible form. We think that dark matter is there because we see the effects of its gravity on visible matter, but we don't know what that dark matter is made from. But some have argued that maybe there is no dark matter, but instead our understanding of gravity is wrong.
Anyway, we shall have to wait and see if Microscope does spot any discrepancy with the equivalence principle, and of course we'll keep you posted on that. More details about the launch are available on the podcast page, and if they do spot something, they may have a result that rivals the announcement in February from the LIGO collaboration about the first ever detection of gravitational waves. These gravitational waves were released when two black holes merged, sending ripples through space-time. Brendan, you've been finding out more about what that discovery means for the foundations of physics.
Indeed. I spoke with physicist Alessandra Buonanno, a member of the LIGO team and director at the Max Planck Institute for Gravitational Physics in Potsdam, Germany, and FQXI member Ted Jacobson from the University of Maryland in College Park, an expert on quantum gravity. They told me about how gravitational waves could be used alongside optical light and other standard observational techniques to probe astronomical objects and to solve some mysteries about neutron stars. They also described what the detection tells us about quantum gravity. I began by asking Buonanno how surprised the team was to detect the gravitational waves now, or whether this was something they were more or less expecting.
The fact is that for binary black holes, we really didn't know the event rates. The predictions were very uncertain, many orders of magnitude, being even close to zero. So we really didn't know.
Alessandra Buonanno at the Max Planck Institute in Potsdam and professor of physics at the University of Maryland in College Park is a member of the team behind the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, or LIGO. LIGO is a gravity wave detector. Gravity waves are tiny ripples in the gravitational field that can travel through space and time, much like electromagnetic waves created by, say, a cell phone tower. Except gravity waves are much harder to detect. This past February, after decades of work, the LIGO team announced the first confirmation of a gravity wave signal. The detection was an amazing vindication of predictions of general relativity made 100 years ago. LIGO is particularly attuned to the gravity wave signal created when two black holes orbit around each other and eventually collide. This is a process called black hole merger. This merger is the type of event which LIGO detected. I asked Buonanno, how rare are events like this, and when can we expect LIGO to observe the next signal?
Well, we have determined in one of the papers that we put out as part of the collaboration, we computed the event rates based on this detection. We only analyzed 46 days of the first run. But the run lasted from mid-September up to mid-January. So we are now finishing to analyze the rest of the data. And the prediction would say even in this data we could observe something. But also in middle of January, the interferometer has been shut down and it will be upgraded a bit, improved the sensitivity, and will come back online in July with a better sensitivity, and it will start a new run that will take 6 months. So for the second run, what we call O2, so the first one was O1, this is O2. If you look at the predictions in our paper, there are some figures, and we could observe between a few events up to even hundreds of events in 6 months. So yes, so the expectations are quite good. So we have to be, of course, prepared, you know, and we are doing our best to be ready when the second observing run starts.
What are you doing with the detector now to make it more sensitive?
So in this second run, we plan to improve a little bit more at low frequencies. Then in 2017, start increasing also the laser power, and then improve the high frequency part of the noise curve.
Confirming general relativity in this way is a tremendous achievement, but physicists will be even more excited if LIGO can show us something that contradicts general relativity. I asked Juanano, if and when LIGO may be able to discover signs of new physics.
Well, we already actually, we had one paper on tests of general relativity because, of course, one of the great things of this event is the fact that for the first time, we are seeing, you know, the high velocity strong field regime when two black holes go around each other and then they merge and they form a new black hole. We did several tests and we didn't find any deviation from general relativity.
As LIGO becomes more sensitive, Juanano added, they could see something new. One thing to watch out for are signals of quantum gravity and the graviton. Quantum theory already describes the fundamental forces other than gravity in terms of particles, such as the photon in electromagnetism. Quantum gravity theory will help complete the picture of the universe and allow us to predict what happened in the very early universe and what happens inside black holes. Some proposed theories of quantum gravity predict a new particle called the graviton, and that this graviton will have a mass, unlike the massless photon. LIGO can already say something about the mass of any speculative graviton and the speed at which it could travel.
We have put a bound on the mass of the graviton. Of course, there are no theories of gravity where the consistent theory of gravity where the graviton has a mass, but you can take more a phenomenological approach and assume that the dispersion relation for the gravitational waves is not the one of GR, so the velocity is not the velocity of light, but, you know, you modify it, it will depend on the frequency or the energy. And so you can actually use the event to put a bound on the mass of the graviton on the Compton wavelength. So this we could also do. So we didn't find, if you want, any deviation from you know, the speed of light, but we could bound the Compton wavelength. So we are already starting, you know, doing this test. It's just that the tests have not revealed any deviation from general relativity.
The most significant thing, immediate impact, is LIGO works. We're going to have a flood of gravitational wave data over the coming decades or even forever. I mean, it's a whole new part of science now. And that's the biggest thing, immediate impact.
Ted Jacobson is a physicist at the University of Maryland in College Park, Maryland, and for full disclosure, my former thesis advisor. Jacobson studies many aspects of quantum gravity and the mysteries of black holes. We talked about the future impact of gravity waves on quantum gravity and other foundational areas of physics. He said the current observation has already had an impact on new physics. Along with the constraints on the graviton, the new data also restricts theories that predict different speeds for different types of gravity waves. Now that we know gravity waves are real and that the detector technology works, Jacobson says we can look forward to even more precise and strict constraints on new theories.
In terms of testing the fundamental field equations or field behavior of the gravitational field, it's already come out with information that Einstein's theory is right, and there's no sign of alternative theories being preferred. But that sort of thing will just become stronger and stronger. I mean, the kind of resolution will get more and more precise measurements that will allow us to rule out even tiny deviations or to uncover tiny deviations, which is more likely what would be interesting. You could imagine that in the future, when we have incredibly precise data, we will uncover something peculiar that goes beyond the current theory and requires some new science. So that's one of the hopes for foundational, but it's totally unpredictable.
According to Jacobson, when it comes to black holes, gravity waves give us the hope to resolve deep questions about the nature of black holes. Some of these questions have confounded theorists for years or even decades. One current debate that podcast listeners may recognize is on whether a person falling into a black hole would have a fairly smooth ride or would be burnt to a crisp by a firewall.
In the future, we should have much sharper measurements, which means much clearer signals of the space-time geometry near the horizon. I would think that this would actually have relevance for the question of whether the horizon has a firewall at it or is a smooth horizon. Nothing could really be more fundamental than that, probably.
Astronomers can also get excited about using the gravitational waves to study cosmic objects in more detail. This will help fill out the pictures we already have through visible light, radio waves, X-rays, and gamma rays. For instance, gravity waves will allow us to learn more about neutron stars, as Buonanno explained.
So we would like to detect not only binary black holes, we would like to see also binary neutron stars and binary, you know, composed of neutron star and black holes. That is also very interesting because you don't have just, you know, vacuum, but you have matter with the neutron star. And so you can observe the neutron star for several minutes. If you want, there are many other things that we would like to do before reaching 2019. There could be electromagnetic counterparts. Astrophysicists think that neutron star black hole could be progenitors of a short gamma ray burst, and it will be impressive if we could see an electromagnetic counterpart of the gravitational wave signal. And so there is a lot of activity between people working gravitational wave and electromagnetic, astronomy to make it happen, to have these follow-ups and find the possible electromagnetic counterparts, either in gamma, in the optical spectrum, in X-ray or in radio, etc. So this is also very exciting.
That was Alessandro Buonanno and Ted Jacobson talking to Brendan. And you can read more about the long-term implications of the gravitational waves detection on the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast.
Now, gravitational waves aren't the only cause of wrinkles in space-time that physicists are hoping to detect. Sabine Hossenfelder, a physicist at the Frankfurt Institute for Advanced Studies in Germany, recently won an FQXI grant to investigate whether it might be possible to test between rival theories of quantum gravity.
In particular, Hossenfelder has been investigating the prediction made by many such theories that the fabric of space-time isn't smooth and continuous when you zoom down to look at it closely. Instead, some theories propose space-time is made up of discrete building blocks. These building blocks could create detectable signatures, which astronomers could pick up as they look at fast-moving particles traveling to Earth from deep in space, as Hossenfelder explained to reporter Colin Stewart.
Quantum theory and Einstein's general theory of relativity were the standout achievements of 20th century physics. But more than a decade into the 21st, and physicists still cannot get them to play nicely together. Should this so-called theory of quantum gravity ever be uncovered, it would allow us to describe both the very small and the very big with the same set of rules. Sabine Hossenfelder at the Frankfurt Institute for Advanced Studies is one of the physicists joining this quest. Given that she's previously studied many other areas of physics, I started our Skype conversation by asking her what drew her to the problem of quantum gravity.
There are different reasons why physicists pick topics that they work on. They like to pick a problem that they think is interesting and has a solution. And people have different tastes in this. So some people think there are problems that I don't think are problems at all, like, for example, the so-called cosmological constant problem. I don't think that's very interesting. But then there are some problems that literally everybody agrees on that it is a problem. And the question how to find a consistent theory that combines gravity with quantum field theory is one of these problems that everybody agrees on that there has to be a solution. And the reason is that we simply know that the theories that we have right now are inconsistent. When you combine them, the outcome is nonsense. So that clearly cannot be how nature works, and there has to be a better answer to this. So that's why I work on quantum gravity, because we know that there has to be a solution. The question is just, what is it?
You're particularly looking at the possibility that space-time is discrete. What do you mean by discreteness?
Concretely, what I mean with discreteness, and this is what appears in these approaches to quantum gravity, is that you have some kind of a network from which space-time is built up. So it's not a smooth, continuous geometry. It's something that's built out of points, basically, that have some kind of relation to each other.
How will knowing if space-time is discrete help the hunt for a theory of quantum gravity?
There are several approaches to quantum gravity, you know, maybe half a dozen or something that you can take seriously, and then there are others that you would maybe not take so seriously. But in some of them, space-time is fundamentally discrete on short scales, and in others, it isn't. So if you want to make headway on finding the right theory of quantum gravity, then the question, is it discrete or is it not discrete, is very central.
So what ideas have people had about its underlying structure?
The simplest thing that you could think of is introducing some kind of a lattice, you know, like an atomic lattice. And people like to talk about atoms of space-time and that kind of thing. That immediately leads to problems because if you have a regular lattice, it will not combine with special relativity. Now, some decades ago, people were not too worried about this because you might have this naive expectation that if the lattice spacing is only small enough and you expect it to be somewhere at the Planck length, that's 10 to the minus 35 meters, so it's really tiny. So you might think that if the discreteness is on a short enough scale, you just wouldn't notice it. The problem is that once you try to combine it with special relativity, you cannot hide this discreteness on short scales. Okay, so that has basically, I don't want to say ruled out, but strongly disfavored all kinds of regular lattices. And we know this already. So the model that I've been working with relies on the imperfection of the discrete structure that necessarily has to be there if it has any quantum effects. So we know that nothing in nature is really perfect. So if a space-time is not fundamentally a continuous and smooth structure, but it comes about as an approximation from an underlying discrete structure, then the smoothness that we use in general relativity should only be approximate, and there should be defects in that space-time.
What effect would these defects have on particles that encountered them?
If you put a defect into space-time, you have a deviation from the smooth geometry. It basically means that you screw up the symmetries of space-time locally. And this means in particular that you do no longer have local conservation of energy momentum. So basically what happens if a particle propagates to space-time and it encounters some kind of defects is that it can change energy and momentum. And this can have all kinds of consequences for particles that propagate through the universe. We would expect these defects to be very sparse. They have a certain density. The density cannot be too high. Otherwise, we would already have noticed this. So if you want to look for space-time defects, you want to look at some particle that travels over a really long distance. So it has a lot of time to encounter some kind of defects. So Earth-based experiments are kind of, that's really interesting. You know, you want something that came to us from very far distance.
How might we be able to spot evidence of these particles encountering space-time defects?
So what you would expect roughly is that the particles get spread out in momentum space, so they have a dispersion to them. And the other thing is that if you have a coherent wave, it would lose coherence as it travels. So people have looked at similar effects before. They have looked at the interference rings from distant quasars. And what you would expect if there is some kind of blurring that comes from a quantum gravitational effects is that the ability of the quasar light to interfere with itself gets lost. This effect should become more pronounced if you have something with a very long wavelength, something that is very spread out in space-time. then it should become more sensitive to defects. And so now the effect that people have looked at in the quasars wasn't a visible range. So what you want to do if you look for space-time defects is you want to look at much longer wavelengths somewhere in the radio regime.
Thank you to Sabine Hossenfelder for chatting to reporter Colin Stewart. You can read more about her work in a profile written by Colin, which we're linking to on the podcast page, fqxi.org/community/podcast.
You know, it's always astonishing to me how theoretical physicists like Hossenfelder are able to use maths to make accurate predictions to test models. In the case of gravitational waves, Einstein posited their existence 100 years ago, and it's taken us a century to catch up and be able to detect them. It shows you how well mathematics describes reality.
Which is our not-so-subtle segue into a plug for FQXI's latest book, Trick or Truth, The Mysterious Connection Between Physics and Mathematics, published by Springer, which is now available to buy or download with links on the podcast page. The volume brings together the winning essays from our last essay contest, which asked why such a connection should exist, or indeed if it is mysterious at all. Our winners are often extremely inventive, and in this compilation, as in the past, we have some works inspired by fiction and written as short stories. That's something that may please our next guest, London-based author Liam Hogan.
It may very well do. Hogan, who has a background in physics and has published numerous stories across a range of genres, recently won a physics fiction contest run by our friends at the Centre for Quantum Technologies in Singapore for his spooky story, Anna, about a young girl who is haunted by thoughts of the multiverse. We'll be listening to Hogan read out his story in a moment in a recording he made for Wandsworth Radio's Blackshaw Arts Hour, which they are kindly letting us use. But before we get to that, I met up with Hogan at a slightly noisy cafe in London and asked him more about his physics background, how it helps with his writing, and what inspires him. So first of all, congratulations. You just won a really nice prize run by the Centre for Quantum Technologies in Singapore for a short story that you wrote that will interest our listeners quite a bit because it's about quantum physics. And, well, I won't say any more about it just yet, but let me first off just sort of ask you about your interest in physics.
Okay, well, I did a degree in physics at Oxford University too many years ago now. And although the job I went to do after that was very much not physics, it was more to do with computing, I've always kept an interest in physics, and I still do. I go to as many events as I can which have a scientific background.
Was writing something that you'd always been interested in and, you know, been doing from a young age?
Yes, it is. It's something I kept on dabbling at in various points. I think I won my first prize about the age of 11 in the local newspaper. It wasn't a very science-based story. It was about a pixie that didn't know its left from its right. And then I kept on dabbling, but never very focused until I went to America. What I was doing was IT for finance, which is very boring, not very bohemian. Because I was living there for a while and had to do something with my evenings, I joined a creative writing course. So yeah, I enjoyed it there, and the creative writing course, which is Gotham Writers, was mainly focused on short fiction, and it just covered the various ways of, you know, telling things from different points of view and, you know, the shapes of kind of stories, but mainly it was encouragement, because although I'd written quite a lot of dabbled stuff, not many people had seen it. It had always been kind of kept slightly hidden. Whereas this course, you had to review other people's work, and they reviewed your work, and you got feedback, and then you tried to improve it. That was kind of key. It was the idea that other people would come back, and they would like what I've written, which hadn't kind of happened or had a chance to happen before.
So let's turn to your sort of your winning story, and we'll try not to put in too many spoilers just yet, but it deals with parallel universes, can I say that? And it's, you know, it's quantum physics, it's the Everettian multiverse, which our listeners absolutely love. But it's also kind of got a sort of a scary side to it. So how did you come up with that? Was this something that originated with the contest at CQT, or was it something you were thinking about already?
It does have some seeds before the CQT competition. I think it was originally started for a theme of under the bed, which will make sense when you hear the story or read the story. And I think it was one of those things where I had a few kernels of the idea and I'd written quite a lot of it. And then the competition came along and I went, okay, well, I have to finish it and send it in for that competition as well. But it's one of those stories I love because quite often I have the idea for a story, but I don't know how to end it. I'm much more ideas writing than character writing. I don't really care about my characters too much. They often die and that's okay. But when I've got an idea, then it's a question of, can the story put that idea out there and can the story still complete? And quite a lot of short stories that I read, they don't have an ending. So I always like a story that has a proper ending. And this one, because of the nature of how it goes, does have that proper ending, which is why it's one of my favourite little stories.
And so, you know, as a writer and as an author, who do you like to read and what do you like to read? What sort of genres, which authors?
I grew up on the classic short fiction, science fiction writers, Asimov, Arthur C. Clarke, lots of people like that. I've read a lot of the old classics, Heinlein, E. Doc Smith, all sorts of weird stuff out there. And a lot of the ideas on things like multiverses, I probably was exposed to them a lot more through science fiction writers than I have ever been through actual science. But that's okay, because we like science fiction for that reason. It exposes ideas and it takes them and does something interesting with them.
So you've kind of partly answered this already, but do you think that having a science background helps you as, you know, if you're writing science fiction, or could just, you know, anybody do it if they've got the imagination and the interest?
I think anybody who has an interest in science has enough, because as I say, I mean, I was exposed to multiverses a lot more through science fiction than I was through trying to do any calculations or equations or anything strange like that. And that was one of the questions that CQT kind of asked in their post-interview was, you know, did you have to do any research? I was kind of going, no. I should possibly have done some research in how psychology and child psychology works, but I didn't do that either. If you're doing real science rather than, you know, fast and light travel and time travel, all of which I've done as well, then, you know, you have to be a bit more careful, because you can easily break rules and you can come up with unrealistic scenarios. But if you're only doing what I tend to do, which is small tweaks to the universe, so a little change rather than hard science fiction where they're reinventing the whole society with a completely new set of technology, if you're only doing small changes, I think it's a lot easier to get away with and you need a lot less solid science to do.
Okay, well, thank you so much for chatting to me today, and I hope the listeners enjoy listening to the recording that you made with the Blackshaw Arts Hour.
Great. Great talking to you. Thank you.
The Blackshaw Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio, where you listen with your ears and not your mouth.
Hello, this story is called Anna. It's weird, the things that can mess up a kid's head. Take Anna, for example. She was convinced that every time she looked under her bed, the universe split in two. In a parallel world in which a mirror Anna also looked under her bed before going to sleep and after saying her prayers, and where, up until then, she'd never found anything bad. This time, there would be a ghastly demon with wicked teeth and blood-stained claws whose only desire was to catch and tear apart Anna, aged 6¾ years. Little wonder she said her prayers before she looked. Little wonder she had nightmares. I told her that wasn't the way the multiverse theory worked. That for every Anna that found a slavering beast, there was one that found a toy she'd lost, or one that forgot to look under the bed. She skewered me with her most outraged look. This Anna never forgot. But it's hard arguing theoretical physics with a child yet to turn 7. And as I wasn't prepared to deny the theory outright, it was clear this notion was not going to be an easy one to shift. It wasn't simply that she had a binary yes versus no, either or view, the coin toss that happened in her imagination every time she lifted the skirt that kept the under the bed out of sight. It was because what terrified her wasn't the finding a monster under the bed. It was the not finding a monster under the bed. In her head, every time she survived, she doomed the parallel universe, Anna, to a grisly death. It was the guilt that was crushing her. "Why don't you not look?" I reasoned. "I have to," she replied with an air of ancient sorrow. "There might be a monster under the bed. I have to check. And even if I don't, the other Anna will." This had me scratching my head, figuratively speaking. I'm a psychiatrist by trade, not a physicist. Wouldn't that require the universe to have already split? And once the other Anna looked, it would be her universe that split again, not this Anna's. Maybe this was something I could use. "Anna," I said, "who looks first, you or the other Anna?" She suspected a trick and trod carefully. "We both..." And then she corrected herself. "There is no other Anna. Not until I look. Or there is, but it's me, and we haven't split yet." "If she is you, will she react to finding the monster the same way you would?" She sucked air through the gap in her front teeth. "I guess." "And how would you react if, when you looked under the bed, you found a monster there? What would you do?" I waited. The silence stretched between us. This was somewhere she hadn't been before. "I don't know." "But you'd do something. You wouldn't just sit there." "No," she agreed. "I'd run, hide, scream, maybe." "I'm sure you would. And what would your parents do if they heard you scream?" "They'd come running." And they would. Any parent would. I let her think about this for a moment. "Anna, you're intelligent, resourceful, and brave. And the other Anna, she is exactly the same. She is, after all, you. She, you, would not take it lying down. Don't think I haven't noticed the hobby horse propped up against the toy chest, ready for action. And the roller skates on the landing." I wasn't sure how the roller skates would help. Perhaps she hoped the monster would trip up on them. She'd be upset if I told her their mother worthily tidied them up each night. "And the skates," I diplomatically agreed. "It's not much, perhaps, but you're doing the best you can. And so would the other Anna. No monster is going to get a free lunch in this house." She laughed, a lovely little laugh, made all the more charming by the rarity of its use. I pushed on. "So it's not a foregone conclusion that the monster always wins. And if it does not..." "Then there are two Annas," she interrupted. This wasn't quite where I'd been going. I wanted her to acknowledge that she wasn't responsible for what happened in the other universes. How could she be? But sometimes, usually in fact, you have to let your patient find their own path. "And then 4, and then 8, and then..." She babbled on. A small chime rang out. "Okay, Anna, I think we've made good progress. We'll leave it there for today." There was a muffled voice at the door. "Anna, honey, Who are you talking to in there? Anna called back. No one, Mummy. Which was an illuminating denial. I jotted it down on my pad for future discussion, curious to see if Anna's mother would come into the bedroom. Okay, sweetie. She caved in, as I suspected she would. But go to sleep now. You hear? Anna waited until the footsteps faded away down the hallway. Good night, Doctor. Good night, Anna, I replied. Sleep tight. And then I slid myself back under her bed, listening to her breathing softly slow, and waiting for tomorrow night, when she would once again lift the covers and, all being well, discover me lying there, ready for our next session.
Scary stuff. That was Liam Hogan reading out his story, Anna, as part of the Blackshaw Arts Hour. We are linking to their site and to Hogan's award-winning story on the podcast page, fqxi.org/community/podcast.
We're also linking to the Center for Quantum Technologies contest page, where you can read some of the other winning entries. You know, I loved Hogan's story because I really sympathize with Anna. I also worry about the fate of my other selves in alternate universes.
I envy my other selves. Just imagine not being tied to this podcast month after month.
Cheer up, Brendan. In the next edition, we'll be celebrating FQXI's 10th birthday.
I feel so old. Double digits.
Oh, there's no pleasing some people. And that's all we have time for in this edition, so thank you again to Alessandro Buonanno, Ted Jacobson, Sabina Hossenfelder, Colin Stewart, and Liam Hogan. You can contact us, as always, at podcast@fqxi.org or on Twitter @FQXI.
She's been Zia Morali.
And he's been Brendan Foster. I'm off to hurl myself from the Leaning Tower of Pisa, all in the name of science.
And I'm going to hide under the bed.